Phones ready. The KZFR app is now up to date and available in the App Store for iPhone, iPad, and iPods. Simply visit the App Store and type KZFR into the search bar. New features include the live streaming, show profiles, and DJ profiles as well. The KZFR mobile apps are the simplest way to listen to KZFR besides the radio itself. Don't forget about our Android app available in the Google Play Store as well. Get the app and share with your friends to make community radio everybody's radio.
All right, welcome to the weekend. 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM. I'm Guillermo Mash for the Chico Vibe. And you are indeed listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Always keep in mind, opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. All right, I'm here with the entire band. Is this the entire Jarduka band? What's up?
This is half of it.
So there's six folks. We got half of the Jarduka band. But I'm here to ask the question, as I do every top of the hour for the show. What does the Chico Vibe mean to you, and how can we improve the vibe?
The Chico Vibe for us, or at least for myself, is community. All of us kind of getting together, rallying behind one another, going out, supporting local events. And I guess the best way we can help it is to go out and support the farmers market, support KZFR, support the music scene. The music scene is kind of in dire need of help, I think, these days. And going out and supporting is the best you can do, in my opinion.
All right. Thanks, man. What was your name?
I'm Steve.
All right. What do you two guys got, man?
Chris?
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, shucks. This is Chris Lawther.
Well, shucks.
Now, I would have to agree with Steve on all that. That's what I remember, is the sense of community and everybody working together and playing together. And there's no extreme of creativity that's discouraged in that sort of format. Everybody's just really excited to be doing something with everybody else, and that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
And that's really, and what Steve said is actually true in our hometown, in my hometown of Columbia. It's just people need to get out. Yeah. Get out and support what's going on when it's going on, because otherwise it won't be going on anymore. Yeah.
Be the vibe by loving the vibe. That's our tagline.
And,
right?
And that's true everywhere. Yeah, I mean, like where I'm from as well. And it's been a long time since I've been here, but I definitely remember the musical family was one of the things that just blew me away. It was so many people, so many musicians all backing each other up, going to each other's gigs. That kind of thing is how you keep it alive.
Well, I wanted to say, you know, these guys coming from the East Coast, being out there, it's not just about keeping Chico alive. It's about keeping all the communities alive with music. And that's what Chris was kind of saying, and where he's at in Columbia, and Travis is up in North Carolina, correct?
Yeah, right outside of Charlotte.
Right outside of Charlotte. So it's about being everywhere. On that note, this Friday we'll be at the Women's Club. This is our Jarduka reunion. Three of the guys flew out from the East Coast. Our keyboardist is coming up from Sacramento. Rich and Scott are here in Chico along with myself. It's going to be a great show. It starts at 7. We're going to go all the way to midnight, and we're going to have our good friends Low Flying Birds do a little in-between set show, and Chris is going to play some banjo with them, so you'll get a chance to see Chris on banjo as well.
All right, and in a little less than an hour, join Marty, Trav, and Chris. They're coming back to Chico. Join up with Rich, Scott, Andy, and Steve for a great night of Jarduka tunes, playing all your favorites plus a few new ones. That's at the Chico Women's Club. Tickets at the door, and it starts 7 p.m.
It's time for the KZFR Music Calendar. On Friday, Berkeley Hart and Brad Peterson will be at the Naked Lounge. D-Vol, Elwood of Chico, Hammer Pants, and Legit Supreme perform at the Maltese. The Friday night concert in the park goes off with the Fritz at 7 p.m. Jarduka plays the first of a two-night reunion at the Chico Women's Club. Open mic will take place at the Down Low at 7 o'clock. And the Pub Scouts will be at Duffy's for the usual happy hour slot. On Saturday, the Americas release their new record alongside Team Skins and Sunny Acres at Duffy's. Destroy Boys, Sacramento-based Garage Rock, will be at Monstro's with Mount Eddie, Bill Nihilist, and Dying For It to open. Radio Relapse will cover the entirety of the Blink-182 album Enema of the State at the Maltese. The Guidance Band will be at Lost on Main at 9 p.m. Stevie Johnson will have his acoustic guitar going at Farmstar Pizza. And Tempo Reggae Night will take place at Sifo's Jamaican Restaurant. And on Sunday, it's a rockin' barbecue during the day with Sex Hogs, The Moans, and Splatter Party at the Maltese. And that's going to do it for the KZFR Music Calendar. This is KZFR Chico. Stay tuned.
All right, give it up again for Jorduka, Chicken Women's Club, about an hour from now. Wonderful time having them in the studio. Speaking of in the studio, we have a great show for you tonight. We have on our newsreel, Chief of Police, Mike O'Brien. We have Leslie Layton from Chico Soul. That's chicosol.org. And she does an interview with A.C. Thompson, investigative journalist, ProPublica, about a hate crimes database he put together. And we got Jason Cassidy right now here on People Power Radio. All right, man. If it's Friday at 6:15 on KZFR, it's definitely Arts Devo time. Welcome to the studio, Jason Cassidy.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Arts Devo. It's happy to be here.
What we got, man? What's up?
This week, I talk about myself again some more. It's usually the entry point into the world. That makes sense, I guess. Yeah, I'm going to Europe. I'm going to go on a little vacation. My wife and I are going to go tour around. And I don't want to make people sick with the details of it. But part of it, we're going to go to Provence, like south of France, rent a car, going to drive around and without a whole lot of agenda and just kind of look around. But in planning, I went on Google Street View, and it was amazing how similar south of France is to Butte County in NorCal.
When you say similar, can you give us kind of like a reference point?
Like, you know, you drive around the back roads around, you know, the orchards or up in Concow or something like that. And it's like, you know, the properties are far apart. There's a crappy dirt road leading to a compound that might have a dilapidated outbuilding, and the grass is all dry. The trees are sort of sun bleached from the long summers. That's what it looked like. Yeah, going down Google Street View, you know, you can kind of look around you, and it looks very similar to that. And then you know, even like the travel sites, they have the picture perfect, you know, lavender fields and Mediterranean sunsets. It brought to mind, you know, we have a lavender field here down in Biggs, and we have beautiful almond blooms, and we have the coastline over on the northern coast. We have the Sierra Nevadas and wine country, and there's a lot of similarities between the two, and it makes sense. We're both Mediterranean climates, and I'm not saying Butte County is the south of France, but it's worth remembering that we have it pretty cool here.
You see any taco trucks? They don't have taco trucks. Come back and tell me if you found taco trucks.
Okay? Well,
tell us. We're going back.
We'll be in some cities, and so I'll be looking around to see what sort of what the street food scene is like.
All right, man. So we won't we'll be blessed with you in the studio for like 2-3 weeks, right?
Yeah, but I'll try. I was thinking I'm going to try and do a little audio missive
awesome.
And send it.
Gosh, I would love that.
I mean, if there's
our listeners would love it.
If there's something interesting, it's just not just me like making people feel bad for being here.
So what else is going on in the art scene, Arts Devo?
To me, one of the biggest things, and I got scooped on this by the man himself, he blasted it on Facebook himself, but Dale Price, Dale the Snail Price, he, you know, longtime local musician and audio engineer, is moving his very popular Electric Canyon Studios from the canyon, for the River Canyon, down into Chico. He's collaborating with the Energy Plant Arts guys, as well as Josh Garcia. He's an engineer from the Bay Area. He most recently, or one of his most recent things, was doing the recording the Vesuvians album.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so Josh, Dale, Electric Canyon guys, including Matt Franklin, another engineer, a young engineer extraordinaire, are going to all collaborate out there. They're going to have this amazing space with lots of equipment. And then Dale's going to recreate the iconic control room in his garage at home, so he can do mixing and, you know, minor fixes and stuff like that there. You know, the technology is changing so much. There's so much that can be done now, and it's only going to be a benefit for the Chico music scene. There's going to be so many affordable options. I mean, you could be recording there at Energy Plants. Dale can just download the files or send them to himself and then go mix over at his house the next morning. And all this equipment, all these facilities, and all these engineers, it's kind of a golden age right now.
So the other thing I thought was kind of cool about that story is he's put together this really It reminds me of Space Truckin', you know, with the little audio mobile thing.
Oh,
like
yeah.
The solar-powered audio mobile unit.
I think that's going to be like the wave of the future for him, because he's also, you know, he's not an audio engineer, so he does sound for everything, you know, from little club shows to the big room to, you know, the Sacred Arts Festival that's happening up in Concow. Anytime, if you turn around and look at the board, there's a good chance Dale's back there.
Well, we'll have Dale and Josh, hopefully. I'm going to reach out to them to do an arts feature in a couple, you know, next week or the week after.
Yeah, ask him about just his history of local bands he's recorded. He's up there at Electric Kenny. He did over 500 albums, most of which were by local bands, including Mother Hips and Mystic Roots. And
what's cool is I've gotten to know the music scene really well for someone who's only been here 4.5 years, but there's so much reverence. I've never heard a discouraging word about their work, his work.
Oh, yeah, he's affected so many people's lives. Like, if anyone's friends with him or friends with his friends on Facebook, go read the post he did and everyone's comments. It's like the outpouring of good memories and love and energy towards Dale, and he's affected and touched so many people in town. My first band in town, we used to rent space in a studio that he rented out, and he recorded us on an old digital system, digital onto a VHS back when they did that. I guess people still do that, but and he plays in bands. He's the drummer for Gravy Brain. He used to play and. Oh, I'm totally losing my chica cred here. A reggae band, super popular, Cornerstone, I think they were called.
Cornerstone. It's a good name for a band.
Yeah. So yeah, drummer extraordinaire, super sweet guy. He's writing a book Boom. About audio engineering. Yeah. Bob Howard has been editing it, and I'm going to help him edit it when it's all done as well.
There's another wonderful person. I mean, Bob, man, I love Bob. I love you, Bob Howard.
We got some cool dudes in town.
We do. He's a brilliant writer too.
Yeah, he is.
Quirky. He's quirky, and he's right to. Yeah, he's got a nice style.
Yeah, he's smart and honest.
Smart and honest. Any closing comments, man?
No. Chico, take care of yourself while I'm gone.
We will. You're almost on the hook now. If their listeners don't hear any of these tapes from Europe, man, they're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, no, I'll be on it.
Awesome, Jason. Take care, man. Safe travels.
Thank you.
The Chico Vibe is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Peter Tikkanen. Tikkanen in association with Baywood Real Estate, a local real estate firm established in 1962. Peter Tikkanen and Baywood Real Estate are happy to support community radio and can be reached at 680-1900 or at chicohomes.com. All right, it's my pleasure to introduce to the production studio here on June 5th, pre-producing for the... We have Chico, Chief of Police, Michael O'Brien. Welcome to the studio, Chief Michael O'Brien.
Thank you very much, Bill. A pleasure to be here.
Today marks the second anniversary of your tenure as Chief of Police, having assumed your duties on June 5th, 2015. Perhaps a moment of reflection on those past 2 years.
Well, it seems to actually have just flown by 2 years, really a blink in the eye in the life of a police chief, I think, in many respects. Other ways, it's been a very long 2 years. It just kind of depends on how you look at it. But really, it's been wonderful. This is a great community to serve as chief. It's a tough place to be a police chief, but it's the best place to be a police chief.
Now, you had some past experience with the Chico Police Department. You were part of the police force. Maybe just a little bit of that. And then
sure.
We'll
so I started my career with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department after graduating from Chico State. Went down to L.A. and realized, L.A. and Chico are not the same. I think I really like Chico. And then back in 1992, I was able to get hired by the Chico Police Department. Very fortunate and blessed to have that happen to me, and have been here ever since. I've done a variety of different things within the police department, and then, as you said, 2 years ago, was appointed chief.
So you've been with the community quite some time.
I have. I love this place, and that's really what drives me. Why I'm here is I love it too, and I think this community is very passionate about, doesn't matter what side of the fence you happen to sit, everyone is passionate about Chico, and that makes it a great place to work.
Let's just jump in here on the crisis intervention trainings. You know, what would that sound like in your words, Mike, and why is it so needed?
It's a way to diffuse situations. That's the way I look at it. It's using techniques, tactics, verbiage to help de-escalate situations. We deal with a lot of volatile situations. Just imagine, we're the ones that come out at 3 in the morning after a domestic violence incident has occurred. We deal with those that are suffering from mental illness in our community every single day. And it's really important that we give our officers the tools to do the very best in de-escalating those situations, because they can be so very volatile. And having that that training from people such as Carol McKinley Alvers, a psychologist that we're bringing up in the summer, actually the end of summer and early fall of this year, September and October, I think will be very, very beneficial to our community, very beneficial to our police officers. We brought her in at the end of 2015, and she trained about half our police officers, and was very well received. We're going to try to do the entire police force, at least the sworn side, and then our dispatchers and some of our records technicians.
So in talking to a fair amount of people about this issue, Chief Michael Bryan, there's a fair amount of people that say, you know, why isn't this already part of their training in the police academy or on a yearly, bi-yearly basis? I mean, what would you say to that?
And it is. Actually, all our officers, and I'll just set the stage by saying our police officers in this day and age are the best trained that we have ever had. In California, your police officers lead the way as far as training, and it's the same way in the Chico Police Department. So they do get this in various forms and fashions in the police academy. And like I said, back in 2015, I became chief in June. That fall in 2015, I realized this was a very, very critical and important issue for our community and our police officers. And we needed to step it up as far as additional training that was not being provided as mandated by California Post standards. So we brought in Carol McKinley Alvarez. We did that above and beyond what is required of us. And she was just dynamic. And we're fortunate to bring her back for two sessions, again in September, October, to do even more of this type of training. We think it's that important. It is not cheap. It's very expensive to hold this training, but we also want to bring in, at least offer to other police departments in the county, this training to include members of the public. We have a venue, we think, lined up that will allow other people to come in to hear her speak and really take advantage of her skill set, which is quite extraordinary.
Thank you for that, Chief. So one question to follow up on that is, Giovanni Cesari, the board chair of the Police Advisory Board, shared with our listeners last week. We had him on last week. We actually played your entire Police Advisory Board presentation.
Right, right.
But he shared with our listeners last week his perception of your support of 40 hours of CIT training. Can you respond to that and maybe expand upon it a little bit, this 8 hours versus 40 hours?
So, and so here's the dynamic for any police department. I can, and I will send a few officers to the 40-hour training. We are committed to that, and I don't know how many we'll be able to send, but you're talking about an entire week, and it's not that that's not valuable. It is, but I cannot send an excessive number of officers through that length of time for training based on other mandatory training that we have to have our people go through. So we have to look for ways to, yes, we'll send people through the 40-hour CIT training because we think there's value in that. Certainly if I could send the whole department, I would, but we still have to run a police department. We have to keep a community safe. And so this is a way we train, just so you know, we have every single month, we have a block of time set out, a full day of training in our police department. Both on the A side and B side, our department's going to split up on the patrol side. On A side, that works Monday through Thursday, and generally Friday through Sunday on the B side. With this particular training model, we can bring in Carol McKinley Alvers, Dr. McKinley Alvers, bring her in and actually do all of our police officers, not just a handful, but all of our police officers in this very critical training. And we think that's very, very valuable. It doesn't mean that the 40-hour training is not valuable. I do find it valuable, but I want to get the biggest bang for the buck and get as many people through this training as I can. And the only way I can get our entire department trained in CIT is this other model.
And actually kind of researching this article, I think there's a term here that would be really helpful to get some insight from you on. But California state law mandates all field training officers, that's kind of a term I'm not that familiar with, have 8 hours of CIT training to be completed by June 30th for officers assigned or appointed before January 1st. Will Chico PD be compliant with this on or before the 30th?
Great question, and yes, they will. So we've already sent our officers through. I think we might have a few more to do, but yes, they will be all compliant with that particular law. We've been obviously paying attention and preparing for that. And the field training officer, just to provide some context, those are the officers that are assigned, that are specially trained and assigned to train all our new police officers, whether they come from an outside agency, whether they come from the police academy. Every one of our police officers goes through about a 5 or 6 month training process. before they're ever allowed to hit the streets on their own. And those field training officers are tasked with ensuring that our officers are absolutely ready for that that challenge.
So would those be the personnel that you have on, in your department, Mike, that you would be looking to send to 40 hours of CIT training? Who has 40 hours of CIT training? What are your plans for the 40 hours?
So a lot of our people that have been through the 40-hour training are typically in our hostage negotiation team, which is part of our SWAT team. And every time a SWAT call out goes out, meaning we have a critical incident, you know, someone, an active shooter, someone with a firearm, something that's very significant, we will activate our hostage negotiating team. And what they do is they provide that expertise in dealing with people verbally to try to resolve, again, an incident peacefully. That's what we always try to do, is resolve incidents as peaceful as possible. And we think this CIT component allows us to do that better. The other thing we're looking at is sending some of our officers to train the trainer courses. And what we want to do is develop a cadre of instructors internally where we can actually increase, from what I just mentioned, the 40-hour, the 16 hours we're going to do this summer, increase this CIT training, this model, with in-house cadre of instructors, and do that more frequently. We can do it in briefing training. There's many, many ways we can incorporate this, and we're looking at training the trainers this summer, sending people out this summer and fall to bring them back with greater expertise to provide in-house training, so we then increase and really double that that effort.
And I would transition to actually a question that came, you know, actually I think after you'd said, hey, let's meet, there was a press release and an announcement on Chico Police Chief announces changes throughout the department. That was the headline from the Enterprise Record, the Daily here. But if we could spend a few minutes talking about those changes, maybe focusing some on engaging the community members that are experiencing mental health crisis.
We announced a couple things last Thursday. One is we had three retirements towards the end of last year and then recently this year in March relative to our command staff, my command staff. It's made up of six other members, myself being the seventh. I had half of my command staff retire. They were eligible, and you know, their service was finished. They did a great job, and it was their time to ride off into the sunset. But then I have to replace those individuals. So I announced the three replacements for those positions. They're at the lieutenant level and then the deputy chief level. And so I introduced them, but I also introduced what we're doing downtown and in our public spaces, specifically our parks, 1 Mile and the parks in the downtown area. And that was to take our South Campus team, which is called our C team. And they typically work the alcohol party related stuff that is very infamous, if you will, in Chico. Mm-hmm. When school is in session, obviously that's not the case in the summer. So we took that entire team, which is a sergeant and five officers, and shifted them to this downtown and then into these very critical public spaces to work on bicycle, to work on a motorcycle, and then walk a foot beat. In addition to that, we also revealed the fact that we have a behavioral health employee working with our target team, actually has been embedded with our target team for several months. We wanted to unveil that the right time after we made sure that that partnership was going to work and us working very, very well, who is essentially a half-time employee working with our target team to go out and do outreach to homeless individuals that are suffering from mental illness. We know there's a nexus between mental illness and many of the homeless population. We wanted to bring services to them. Sometimes it's very difficult to bring services to people in this community when they're living under a bridge or elsewhere. This model where our target team is having contact with those individuals, having that employee, behavioral health employee, essentially embedded with our target team has proven very successful, and we wanted to release that to the public.
So in that article, Enterprise Record article, it uses the term quality to focus on quality of life issues. What does quality of life issues mean to Police Chief O'Brien?
I'd say quality of life crime. We don't deal with anything other than really behavior. Behavior. What we want to provide is a safe place for our community, all our community, to enjoy. Meaning if there's a park that is overrun with criminal element, drug use, theft, fighting, that kind of thing, that really will deter many times all of the public from enjoying those public spaces. We want to make sure that we're providing a safe place, safe parks, safe public space for everyone to enjoy and use. And that's really what those officers concentrate on. The fact that they're out on a motorcycle, the fact that really most of them are out on a bicycle or in a footbeat capacity, that makes them more accessible to the public to have conversations. So what's going on with your business? What's going on in the park here? Are you feeling safe? And I'm sure you'll probably have a knock on your door here before too long to see how things are going for you guys. You're part of this downtown community. We want to make sure that when you leave for the night, your employees feel safe. When you come in the morning, you feel safe. It's really an effort to make this entire downtown and our parks a safe place to live, work, and recreate.
And one thing I would add, just to get some clarity around, you know, folks experiencing homelessness, everyone's at some level of mental health anguish. I mean, it's a horrible situation to be in. I actually came from that population for a short period of time, and Bobby Walden, who runs the Hunt Vash program, chief, I'd said to him, you know, hey, I was in submarines, I'm, you know, pretty sound mentally. He says, you know, anyone that's experiencing homelessness is going through a mental health crisis. So, I mean, what would you say in regards to that and how your staff needs to respond accordingly?
And that's an excellent point, and that's why bringing in experts other than just our, you know, we're police officers, and I can train them, and they're, like I said, the best trained officers we have ever had, and in California, the best trained officers in the nation. But we need to partner with other organizations that have a different level of expertise that we don't necessarily share. Yes, we have experience. Yes, we have training. Yes, we have a number of things that makes us certainly more qualified. But the best qualified people are those in the community that really have an expertise in homelessness, that have an expertise in mental health issues. And there's nothing better from my perspective as to partnering with behavioral health and bringing out an actual behavioral health employee to bring those services to bear where people need them most. And that's really on the streets. And I think that's an excellent model. I'm very proud of that. And I think you'll see some good things. We would like to see that expanded to include other service providers. We're looking at ways to do that. But really starting with this mental health piece, I think, is very critically important for our community.
Well, once again, you're listening to Chief Mike O'Brien here on the Chico Vibe. But, you know, we've been talking 12, 13 minutes here. Good time for closing comments. Anything you want to circle back on or elaborate on?
No, just the 2 years you mentioned have been outstanding. And really, it's a 2 years of a community that cares. And like I said, that's what makes this place special. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle that you happen to sit. Everyone is passionate about Chico. They want it to be the best it can be. We have different perspectives maybe to do that. But the fact that people care so much, to me, tells me that it's a special place, and we need to continue to make it a special place. And whatever I can do as a police chief, I want to do my part to make it that special place.
Thanks, Chief O'Brien.
Thank you, Bill.
The Chico Vibe is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the local seasonal and organic delights at Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar Future features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts with vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open Monday through Friday for lunch, noon on Saturday and Sunday, and for dinner 7 nights a week with live music on Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday at 2359 The Esplanade. Visit farmstarpizza.com or like his own Facebook. All right, back here live in the studio, KZFR, downtown Chico for the Chico Vibe. And I want to just have a couple of words, opinions around the interview and the Police Advisory Board. And I thank Chief O'Brien for coming in and spending so much time to put that 30-minute piece together. But I believe the Chico Police Advisory Board should actuate the Butte Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, and their request to be added to the Police Advisory Board as a member. This would fill the gap, which has been echoed by others in the community I've spoke with, to have grassroots and street-level facing groups on the board itself. I would like to see that actuated, as I just mentioned. And I also want to have a little comment around police behaviors versus quality of life. Police on behaviors versus quality of life. This is one and the same. This is one and the same. It's not behavior-based, quality of life-based. They're not different symmetrically. In that Chico, the city of Chico's instituted the toughest, they're the toughest anti-homeless laws on the books in the state of California. And they've made it illegal anywhere in the city limits to exercise activities that anyone with a home takes for granted, such as sitting, gathering, and sleeping in public. Example I had downtown last week was I saw a blanket, and I saw cops heading towards the blanket. And I watched it from across the street in the Hasmeans. And they left, and they went into the plaza, and the people with the blanket were sitting on the blanket. Now, and I went over to them, and I asked them what had happened, and in stereo, they basically said, we were told we couldn't have this blanket over us while we're sleeping, and we're not out here by choice. And these two people looked like they were completely exhausted, and they kind of actuated their will and way. As soon as the police left, they went back under the blanket. So I really want people to understand that this whole behavior thing is being twisted into looking at just basic quality of life issues. I don't think there's anyone that would argue that someone that's dealing drugs or that's creating a fight or that pulls out a knife or these very few incidents that happens in a fairly safe town such as Chico. I just don't feel it's right to paint the whole community, a marginalized community, with that. And I'd also ask that the police department and the city of Chico start to look and actuate this community policing model. I hear so much about it needs to be clean and safe for everyone that comes downtown. That's not what happens if you're homeless. It's anything but. You do not feel welcome. You do not feel safe if you are destitute living in Chico. Okay, I don't want to get any more on that. But we'll be going into this in more detail alone as it relates to the private property business improvement district, or PBID, that is up for ballot count on July 5th, Chico City Council. We cover the PBID in the next two The Chico Vibe shows, starting next week with Tom D. Giovanni, the steering committee chair for the PBID. Next up, we have a really nice interview. It was the sound engineer guy. But we have Leslie Late, news editor of the online news magazine, ChicoSoul.org. That's ChicoSoul.org. And she has a wonderful interview with an investigative reporter, Emmy-nominated investigative reporter A.C. Thompson, of the well-recognized online ProPublica, who's going to discuss a hate crimes database that has been made available nationally for journalists to have news leads and to look at trends. So no further ado here on People Power Radio. Right, Gamo Mash here on behalf of the Chico Vibe, KCFR Chico Vibe. And I'm here in the studio. We're going to do a synopsis for a piece we're doing. And I have Leslie Layton, the editor for ChicoSoul.org, a local investigative journalism online mag. Welcome to KZFR, Leslie Layton.
Thank you so much, Bill and the Vibe.
So what do you got for the Vibe? I know you've got a pre-recorded little synopsis here. Maybe we can hear that to lead into our long-form piece with AC from the ProPublica.
I'm editor of this online magazine that Bill just mentioned, ChicoSoul.org. We launched Chico Soul more than a decade ago to tackle cross-cultural issues that we felt needed more community attention. So today we're here to talk about our participation in the project Documenting Hate. And this is led by the national news organization ProPublica. ProPublica is a nonprofit national newsroom producing some of the best investigative reporting in the country right now. It's ProPublica.org. We have a pre-recorded interview for you with A.C. Thompson, the staff reporter who came up with the concept of a national database to track hate crimes and what he calls bias incidents. AC is going to talk about what journalists hope to accomplish with the database and how we in Chico can support and participate in this project. Many of AC's stories examine the criminal justice system and in one case help lead to the exoneration of two innocent San Francisco men who had been sentenced to life in prison. And in another case, to the prosecution of seven New Orleans police officers. In addition to working as a print and web journalist, AC has reported for television, serving as producer and correspondent for the PBS documentary series Frontline. ProPublica is now working with newspapers and civil rights organizations across the country to track trends in hate incidents with a special focus on what has occurred since the election of Donald Trump in November. As a partner, Chico Soul now has a reporting form available at ChicoSoul.org that any member of the public who has experienced a hate incident can fill out and submit to the national database.
And Chico Soul can be found at ChicoSoul.org. So thanks for that, Leslie. And now we're going to lead into this interview with A.C. Thompson here on The Chico Vibe. Gamma Mash for The Chico Vibe. We're here with A.C. Thompson from ProPublica and Leslie Layton from Chico Soul. So welcome to KCFR, both of you fine people.
Thanks
for having me on.
Where are you located right now? Where are you sitting right now, A.C.?
I'm in Berkeley, California. I live in a small town called El Sobrante, California, not far from here.
AC, thanks for making time for the interview. Tell us about the database, why it was established, and what ProPublica would like to accomplish.
You know, so what became clear to myself and to the other people on our team back in November of last year was that the FBI stats on hate crimes are abysmal, that they are absolutely a massive undercount, that they don't capture the true scope and scale of hate crimes in America, and that the Bureau itself and other people at the Department of Justice admit as much. So about 20% of the law enforcement agencies in the country do not submit hate crime data to the FBI. And of the agencies, the law enforcement agencies that nominally participate in tracking hate crimes, about 80% of them say, hey, hate crimes never happen in our jurisdiction. So I would call those, you know, not particularly diligent efforts at tracking hate crimes. Our feeling was, wow, there's this massive data gap out there, and is there a way that we can help to fill it? And so what we set out to do was to work with a coalition of news organizations and civil rights groups, many of them serving different ethnic and religious communities, and say, hey, if people in your network, if your readers, if your listeners and viewers feel that they've been subjected to a hate crime, have them report it on this form, and we will channel it all into a single database and help sort of augment the federal data. You know, we're not looking to supplant it. We're not looking to be final. We're not looking to be the perfect data set. But what we're looking to do is add another layer of understanding to what's out there.
But the database also includes bias incidents, correct? And can you tell us what those are?
Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, another thing that we wanted to do, rather than just collect things that are going to be categorized as hate crimes under federal law or under state law, is to collect incidents of bigotry, intolerance, hatred, bias that don't rise to the level of being a criminal offense. Because, you know, this is really the vast bulk of what happens, is people behaving badly to one another, but not necessarily breaking criminal law. So we're asking people, you know, if you've been targeted by someone who disparaged your ethnicity verbally at the store, if you've been the victim of online harassment, etc., please report these kind of incidents to us. So an example would go like this. I interviewed a Mexican-American gentleman who lives in Pennsylvania the other day, and his story was about going to the Costco in his town and a white gentleman coming up to him and saying, hey, I'm a member of a militia. I was just down on the border. We're going to get rid of all you people. All you Mexicans are going to go back to your country. You better look out. And of course, the guy who was getting harassed is an American citizen, so who happens to be ethnically Mexican American. And those are the kind of incidents. You know, this is not a crime, but it's obviously harassment, it's obviously disturbing, and it's the kind of thing that's not really being tracked right now.
Would you call this hate speech? Is that a good phrase to use? And I'm interested because somebody I interviewed this past week just said to me, what is hate speech, and how would you define it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really murky area, right? Like, hate speech is a poorly defined category that's sort of very subjective, right? I would use a different terminology, and I would say that it's an incident of harassment, it's an incident of bigotry, it's an incident of bias against somebody's ethnicity and perhaps national origin. The hate speech thing, I feel like, is a label that gets thrown out, and it means a lot of different things to different people. So it's not one that I find particularly useful, honestly.
Interesting. So as I've started to talk to people around here about the database, a lot of people look at me sort of quizzically and say, there's an incident of bigotry every day in Chico. Are we really going to submit a report to your national database and, you know, say, oh, Chico again? What is the purpose of doing this?
We definitely want those kind of incidents that are not absolutely atrocious, that are nasty, but they're not the most horrible things out there. They've become routine. We want those because we are bearing witness to a moment in history in which this sort of bigotry absolutely seems to be on the rise, and it seems to have become ubiquitous. And so part of it is documenting that ubiquity, that sense that we are becoming inured to this kind of bias and bigotry and hatred. So yeah, we do want that stuff. You know, one really key thing with the database is, you know, there's around 3,000 incidents in it, and the reporters that are part of our network are mining that database for patterns, for trends, for phenomenon that may go otherwise unnoticed. And so, you know, a big thing about this is that it is a tip sheet for journalists to understand better what's going on at this moment. And I think we've been pretty effective in using it that way, you know, from uncovering a pattern of Indian Americans, immigrants from India, being harassed, abused, threatened, to, you know, this exactly what you were talking about, this sort of verbal meme of telling people to go back to your own country, which a couple of our outlets have done stories about. You know, what we're looking for is sort of the narrative that is behind the statistics.
And should the database be used for statistics?
No.
So it's really to look for patterns, for trends. But tell us a little bit about the vetting and what are the limitations of the database?
Yeah, so the organizations that are part of our network, the news organizations and civil rights groups, they can all look into the database and check out these different incidents that have been reported by the different partners in the project. And so, for example, anything that comes in through ProPublica, I can immediately look at and pull up all the detail on and contact the people who contacted us. I can also look and I can see what was reported to the New York Times or to BuzzFeed or to Univision and get most of the information there. And if I'm interested in further pursuing the tips that have come into them, the reports that have come into them, I just contact them and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in looking into this allegation. Can you share the contact info with me of the person that made this allegation? And when we get the contact information of these people, either through our partners or through my organization, what we do is we contact them, we call them up, we ask for any kind of documentary proof that they have, that they filed a police report, that they took photos, that they posted on social media right after it happened, a video, you know, that sort of thing. And so what we're really trying to do is vet these incidents to and report on them, just like any kind of reporting, to assure that these are genuine incidents, and as far as we can tell, that these are authentic reports of bias, abuse, and hate crimes.
And there's a certain level of confidentiality when you submit the form, so that contact data is only available to those of us who are partners, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And so the contact data, like I said, that comes into ProPublica, that lives with us, and that stays with us, and we can share it with other members of the project, but it stays within the project, and, you know, the other partners on this effort have to contact us and ask us, hey, can you share that information with us? And then, if the information is shared, it is flagged in the system, hey, so-and-so is reaching out to this alleged victim. That will be the point of contact for the victim so that they are not getting deluged with calls from media organizations around the country and getting re-traumatized and feeling maybe like, this is more than I wanted to deal with, but that there's one reporter reaching out to them, not a swarm of them.
And was the database established right after the election on the premise that people were feeling empowered to be more openly hateful? Do we know for sure that there's been an uptick in incidents, or is that a theory?
Well, you know, part of it was this, is that I'm a student of the far right. It's a subject that I've been fascinated and disgusted by for a very long time. And so over the last year of the election campaign, I was watching more and more signs that there was a reinvigorated racist right, and that there was more activity from the white supremacist and supposed white nationalist sector than there had been in years and years. And so I already knew that something was afoot that was unusual in American life, and that this was a phenomenon that was happening. Meanwhile, late in the election campaign and in the days after the election, there seemed to be a lot of reports of racist graffiti, racist harassment, and racist crime that was linked to the election. So this is graffiti that says, "Make America White Again," playing off the Trump campaign slogan. Or this is graffiti that says Trump with a big swastika where the M should be. Or this is, you know, verbally yelling in school at kids with brown skin, build the wall, get out of my country. You know, that sort of stuff that really, in terms of a narrative, seemed to be connected to the themes that were big during the election. So we thought it was important to look at that. It is impossible to say absolutely conclusively that there has been a uptick in hate crimes since the election, because the FBI data, as flawed as it is not yet available. And the 2016 data will be available in late 2017. And so even that will only capture a part of this phenomenon. What I can say is the data that's collected at a local level, if you look at the cities that will now produce hate crime stats for what's going on in their cities, 2016, early 2017, you will see what seems to be a significant surge in hate crimes in many cities across the country during 2016 and so far in 2017. It's not conclusive, it's not the whole country, but the early reports seem to indicate that there is an increase.
Well, that's interesting. And I read an article recently, you may have seen it in Salon, from the Center, an interview with the Center for Hate, Study of Hate and Extremism at San Bernardino. Did you see that article?
No, but I talked to Brian Levin a lot, the guy that runs it.
They were reporting that California, actually, the hate crimes were increasing faster than in the country as a whole, and that in 2015 there was this huge spike that was actually bigger than the national average, which is surprising. Is California, is that your impression, that California is really sort of at the forefront of this far-right movement?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think there's an important distinction to make, right? And the distinction is between sort of the casual racists who are not part of an organized hate crimes movement or an organized hateful movement, right? And then you have the organized extreme right racists. I would say that the organized far right racist movements have become an incredibly diffuse scene. That, you know, in earlier days, these were movements that were built around small cells of people, whether it was Klan groups, whether these were skinhead groups, whether these were Aryan Nations groups, that actually were people who met in person and hung out and got guns and handled their business in their racist fashion. What I think you see now is a much, much more diffuse networked movement that really is propelled by the internet. And I think, like, sort of tracking the geography of that has become very, very difficult because of that. When you look at those 2015 hate crimes numbers on California, they're definitely concerning. They're definitely worrisome. I think one of the things that you may see in California is it may be partially a reporting effect, though. Mm. And that is that California has mandated hate crimes training for all police recruits when they go through the academy. California has very good reporting by local police departments up to the state attorney general, and then that information is then forwarded on to the FBI. And California does a really good job of tracking these cases all the way through the process. So from the time that there's a report of a hate crime to the time the case is adjudicated. And partially what you may be seeing is a better reporting, better documentation.
So you mentioned that we have sort of like casual racists and then an organized movement. And one thing I'm interested in is, how does publicity about what they're doing affect them? And does reporting to the database, and then when people see stories come out, does it feed them and sort of They think, wow, I got some publicity for that. Great. Or do they feel embarrassed?
My thinking on this is that there is often an unintended consequence of reporting on, I think particularly reporting on organized hate groups and the activities of organized hate groups. I think to a certain extent, the media amplifies their message by reporting on it. And I think that's somewhat unavoidable. And I think it's an unwelcome, unintended consequence of just doing the reporting. If you report on Richard Spencer's activities, or if you report on the activities of the Daily Stormer, the fascist website out of Ohio, you are giving them publicity and spreading their name around, and they may find a larger audience because of it. There was a group called Adam Waffen that's a young neo-Nazi group, mostly younger 20-something types. And, you know, one of their tactics was to put up offensive posters at college campuses, wait for the media and the students and the faculty to get upset, disturbed, enraged, and to then ride that wave of media outrage and publicity to find a larger audience. And they would get a larger audience than just, you know, the flyers they put up on campus that would only be seen by people on campus. Now they're reaching tens of thousands or millions of people. And so that's absolutely a tactic that they were using. At the same time, I think if people put up neo-Nazi flyers at your school or in your town, it's hard as a person of conscience and as a journalist to ignore that. You know, it's hard to figure out how to straddle that line of not encouraging these people and at the same time saying, like, hey, this is going on where we live, where we work, where we go to school, and it's something that folks should be aware of.
So it doesn't do anything to discourage the casual racist. They don't.
You know, with the casual racist, this is like a phenomenon that I see. This is a pattern that I see, is people do nasty things. They do awful things. They end up getting kicked out of school. They end up getting disciplined. They end up getting criminally prosecuted. And when there are those consequences, they often say, like, oh, you know, what I did was messed up, and I feel embarrassed, and I feel stupid, and I feel like, you know, I need to be a better human being. And I think that that process sometimes does have, you know, this sort of, those consequences sometimes do have a sort of transformative effect on the perpetrators when people are allowed to do these sorts of incidents and remain anonymous. Then they just tend to keep doing them, you know. It can also go the other way. You know, there was one of the real prominent neo-Nazi hackers, a guy who goes by the name Weave, who is deeply involved in the neo-Nazi movement. You know, he's a guy who went to prison and decided that it was the Jews and people of color that were ruining his life, and that hardened his resolve, you know, and made him more of a racist. And so it can go both ways, but I hear a lot of stories about people being convicted of hate crimes and saying, hey, you know, I want to reach out to the people that I've victimized and sort of, you know, find some understanding and apologize and actually do community service in that community to try to make up for it. So I think it's a mixed bag.
And there's one thing we haven't talked about that we really need to, and that's, you know, how to access this database, how to follow your project on Facebook and Twitter. So maybe if you could land on that for a little bit and some closing comments.
Yeah, so the main hub for the project is at documentinghate.com, and that will take you to all the stories that are put out by the partners, all the information about the partners, et cetera, et cetera. We are also on Twitter at documenthate is the handle. You can follow the ProPublica Facebook page, has information on it as well. And we've got a ton of partners. The whole list of partners is there on the website, and we're really excited to have a massive, massive collection of good journalists working on this.
And I just want to add that the first report from Chico to be entered in your database was about a defaced flyer on Chico State University campus right after the election, where someone had crossed out "Your vote matters" and said,
Trump matters, MAGA, and then use some white supremacy language, 1488, I guess. So, you know, that was something I, when I was contacted about it, I followed up on, and it turned out to be really interesting. The woman who had put up the flyer about that saying your vote matters was devastated about what had happened to it. And there hadn't been really any public discussion about that, you know, that defacing. And so I think that this is a really good thing in terms of not normalizing this stuff. But I just want to encourage members of the public that if you've experienced a hate incident or you think you've been a witness to a hate crime, there is a form available on ChicoSoul.org that you can fill out. It will be submitted online to the ProPublica database, and your name will be confidential to the extent that it won't become public unless you give your permission. Is that a pretty good assessment of how it works?
Yeah. Okay. And that's both disturbing that incidents are coming in Chico and exciting that people are taking advantage of the platform and that desire to report.
I appreciate your time today helping us explain why the database can play an important role and what it's for. So thank you.
Well, hey, thanks for having me on. I'm happy to do it.
All right, Guillermo Mass signing off. I do want to thank Leslie Layton and AC Thompson of ProPublica. But Leslie had done a nice job not only in that interview, but she's posted two recent articles to the ChicoSoul.org. One titled Bigotry Stress More Evident in Chico State, and that's all around that flyer and how that was entered into the hate crime database. And then there was one just several days ago that would be maybe paraphrases the bias incident, but it was the CSU student newspaper Sparks Hate Speech Debate. So you'll be able to go out and find those two wonderful articles by ChicoSoul.org, who does our news feature once a month, every second Friday. So I appreciate their care and concern for the city of Chico and some of the news that they report on. And we're going to take you out with George Duca, man. Get on down. Women's Club, 7 o'clock. And until next week, keep on listening to People Power Radio. All right. We had one half of George Duca leading the show, and we're going to have one half of George Duca ending the show. Who do we got in the studio here? Introduce yourself.
Steve Hoffman, play percussion.
Chris Lawther, guitar, vocals.
And Travis Hunter, guitar and vocals.
All right, guys, tell our listeners a little bit about George Duca, the reunion.
Chris?
the reunion is sort of, that's of Steve's creation, and we all have him to thank for sort of pushing it to happen. Otherwise, we would have all just gone our separate ways, living our lives in our respective hometowns, and that would have been that. We had a great following and a great time and a bunch of good friends and just folks that we love to see all the time way back when, and that's it. But hopefully it's not too much trying to relive or anything like that. Hopefully we're actually, you know, creating or something like that. I don't know. Bringing our new found and vast musical experiences with us.
And I think, like it says, it's reunion. We're getting back together, all of our friends. I mean, we have friends flying in, driving in, yeah, that we haven't seen forever. We did this about 4 years ago. We're doing it again because we had so much fun. And then there's a lot of old-timer people that are here in town that we get to see again. Quickly, we had a little write-up on our page. This girl sent us a message and said, I grew up with my parents listening to this song called... She quoted the verses of the song called Ooh Ooh. And she's like, I fell in love with this song and I've never seen you, but my parents always used to go see you and played your CD. And will you play that song if I come see you? We were like, absolutely. And it was just like, gave
so
us goosebumps.
You just dated
so
us.
So we
there.
Dated us. That we're old. We're old now. But it was really cool that, you know, this little girl that's never heard us, and she's going to bring her daughter. So she's like, and I'm coming with my parents. So there'll be three generations of people that love George Duca music. And that's really what it's about. That's the reunion right there.
It sure is, Steve. That's a vibe for sure. Hey, tell us what to expect at the show. The show is going to be like just a few minutes, man. If anyone listening, they should be heading over to the Women's Club. Absolutely. To catch the show, man. But what can we expect?
Shucks. All the classics. And then hopefully we'll have a couple surprises worked up our sleeves. Like I said, we're all coming at this with fresh eyes since we don't have the opportunity to play with each other all the time. So it's going to be whatever musical experiences we've had over the past, you know, 5 and 20 years that suddenly come to play in whatever we're doing.
Absolutely.
And we were kind of improvisational a little bit to begin with. So it'll be interesting to see what that yields now.
Yeah, last night we were at practice and Travis threw a new song at us and it went over well. I mean, it was great. So it was exciting to have some new music injected into the old stuff that we've done.
Why don't you lead us into this song, Soul Rhythm Dance?
Soul Rhythm Dance is one of the first Jorduga compositions ever. Really, it was just a moment of tooling around with a guitar in a bedroom, and then I think Travis and Scott kind of came up with the lyrical parts of it, and that was that. This song was recorded at Alex Belden's place back in the 90s. Yeah.
96,
and yeah, it's sort of the first
Jorduga song.
Yeah, first footprint on the jam map for Jorduga.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys, looking forward to that show, and that's going to be tonight, man. As you're listening to the show, get on down, Women's Glow. All right, guys, take care.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.